Richard Deacon, we're now in a park just slightly outside of the central buildings, central galleries of Documenta 9, standing by your piece, and I have to say the first question that comes to mind is there are children playing on it, there are people sitting on the sort of aluminium boundary that runs around the wooden work. I mean, the public involvement, is that something that worries you, or are you happy about that?
I have mixed emotions, in fact, because I anticipated a certain amount of user use of the work, and when you make something of this height, you've got to accept that people will sit on it and will use it, and particularly in such a popular area of the park. So I had anticipated that. I mean, I do have... I don't particularly like watching it. It makes me uncomfortable because I always worry that I'm going to see someone do some damage. You know. I have kind of mixed emotions. I mean, in principle, I quite like the fact that people enjoy the work, you know, and in a park you can't actually legislate as to how people should behave in front of a work, and you rely on a certain amount of, there's a kind of good faith that goes on between you and the public as to whether the thing survives or not. Basically, that's so. I have mixed emotions. I mean, the work seems to not to attract antagonism. I mean, it's just there's a lot of people and it's a nice park, and so there's a lot of children, and the children will always play on things that are around. I mean, I quite like the way children do use things. They themselves can't do the work any. They can't do the work any real damage. I mean, it's they might scratch the surface a bit, but that's not, you know, it's not irreparable.
Did you choose the particular location here in this park?
Yeah, very much so. The site is actually I chose a site that was viewable from above. I mean, and as you come down the steps. In fact, it's a very visible position, although it wasn't obvious as such until I put the work here, but it was actually a very clearly visible place from almost all over there as you walk around the park. And the trees, I chose a relationship between the trees, and when I first came here, without the pavilions, the trees are very particular in this park, very individual and very precise in their relationship one to the other. And I wanted to try and make a work that was as individual and as precise in its relationship to the other things around.
In the mock-up or visualisation, the catalogue, in fact, you made three-dimensional models of the trees.
Yes, that's right.
That you then made a drawing and a maquette. Can you talk a little bit more about how the piece actually relates to the two trees? Because they seem to have been important features in how you formulated the work.
It was to do with, well, as I say, I mean, it was to do with the characteristic of individuality in the trees, and the very interesting formal relationship they have, and the wanting to work in between them, as against sort of as against somewhere else, so that the which is precisely located. In fact, this is the lowest point of the park as well. So the model was a means of trying to work out some of the scale things, and I'd actually think I'd probably intended to make a higher work when I first started, a taller work, and I realised afterwards as I began that I didn't want to make a work that was in the park that was taller than a person. So I mean, it's intended to be not to dominate, which partly accounts for the kind of use it gets, is that it's set at such a low level that it's very easy to climb on or to sit on.
Right. In fact, I mean, that's the next kind of comment, really, that there are people sitting on, I don't know whether you would describe it like this, but an elliptical aluminium wall, really, that's thick enough to sit on, and the height that is appropriate to sit on, within which there is, again, whether you would describe it like this, but a pod-shaped kind of fabricated wooden sort of object within it. How did the two elements arrive or arise? It's easy to talk about that.
That's not particularly easy. That's not particularly easy to talk about. The I don't really have a clear account of that sort of pre-formulation business, other than having the model in the studio for a long time, putting things on it and taking things off. And there are a number of other works which have used a surround and a central core, so that the work in Munster, for example, had that, and the work in Sonsbeck Park in Arnhem had a similar format. And it's originally, when I started using that as a format, it was to do with making a distinction between structure and body, if you like, form and non-form. I've also made some works which, for example, in a work that's in Canada, which has a one section stands up on a set of steps, which also function as a bench, and the other section the other section steps outside that, so that there is a possibility of viewing the exterior as a kind of base, and the height. The height at which it's set does have something to do with the level of the height at which it becomes the height that you could sit at. And I've got no objection to people sitting on the work and to sitting around the work. It's another way of dealing with it, as far as I'm concerned. So those two things, I think, come together. One would be a set of works which try to use a kind of an unformed interior as a sort of substance, and a structural exterior as a kind of structural exterior, which is the form. Another group of works which use either a height, which is basically a sort of sitting height, or a semi base, which also functions as a seat. So those two things are sort of married together in the work. The elevation of the ends has to do with undermining the denotation of the exterior as a container for the as a enclosure for the interior, and to do with undermining its status as a base.
Is it a reading that interests you, the way that you have, you know, the metallic kind of collar, if you like, around something that's very, it gives a sense of something organic, something that's growing, that's a pod that could actually become part of some sort of living organism at some point, but contained within this sort of metal collar?
Well, I mean, that's certainly one evident reading in the work. The title of the work is Bikini. The obvious answer to the question as to why it's called that is because it has two parts. It also has a ring around it, like an atoll. So, and the interior has a kind of full sexuality to it. And the word and bikini kind of entered the language for two reasons, almost simultaneously. The first explosion at Bikini Atoll was 4 days before the two-piece swimsuit was introduced at the in 1946, I think it was. The designer used the word bikini in reference to Bikini Atoll, so that there is a whole set of very interesting kind of relationships between the organic and the inorganic, the destructive and the procreative, the trivial and the deadly serious, which are a kind of sort of subtext to the work. And in some ways, you could almost describe the sort of foundations of post 1945 Western democracy as being based on the That duality of motif, which a certain kind of freedom of lifestyle coupled with an awesome threat. And that kind of darkness isn't particularly present in the work, although the connotations of seed within the central section, and even some of the connotations of shape, do have, you know, that kind of side.
Do you have anything to say about the context of Documenta? I mean, you're actually away from what I could describe in quotes the politics of placement within the kind of very specific spaces. You're out here in the park.
I chose to be out in the park because I really didn't want to get involved in the politics of space on the interior. And I also was invited to make a work, to consider making a work for outside, which very few artists were. Whereas in like the last documentary, a very large number of artists made work for outside space. So, I mean, I gain a lot from the fact that there aren't, that the work does actually have its surroundings, and the relationship to place remains fairly clear. I had in my model, I had included the temporary pavilion, so there's no difference in aspect to my model. They're slightly closer than they'd appeared in my model and in the plan that they've been sent, but I mean, that's fairly trivial. I think that the from my point of view, that those sort of those political questions don't actually apply. I have the site that I wanted in a clean situation, and if the work succeeds or fails, it's my business, rather than being able to say, you know, well, it's fucked up by having to make compromises at the last minute. I've never done a documentary before. It's the first documentary I've done. The quality of Carnival that it has is slightly surprising to me. It's more exuberant than I would have thought. In general terms, I think there's two things that go on in these situations. There's one, a certain kind of politics, as you mentioned. There's the other, that in fact it's... the people who probably get the most out of documentary are people who don't go to very many shows, because it provides an opportunity for them to see a large collection of work at one time and to engage with it in a way which almost no other situation provides. Because, I mean, even in a big show that is in one location, people don't kind of party around in quite the same way, and don't live with the art as you have to do if you want to try and see documentary. You do have to give up a considerable amount of time, and you do have to put some legwork into it, and you do see work in a variety of different stations. And I mean, the sequence you see work is going to colour the what you think, etc. So I mean, whereas for someone who's seen a lot of who sees a lot of exhibitions, a lot of the time they may think, well, you know, he didn't do so well, they did, she didn't do so well, she did very well, etc. You know, I mean, those they're badly shown. I mean, those concerns tend to be kind of foregrounded, which is probably not the almost an art audience is not the best audience, I don't think, for Documenta. A corollary for that would be to ask the questions to whether for an art audience, whether given that you know the work, whether you can construct a discourse, what sort of discourses around it, and form some idea of what the documented teams cut through the strata of art world activity at one point means. And that seems to be much more difficult to come up with. I mean, talking before, it seemed fairly clear, but to be honest, I can't really make clear distinctions between why, for example, Richter is down in the temporary pavilions rather than the Frederiksjarnum is hard to know. I mean, maybe it was his choice. There does seem to be a tendency for Frederiksjarnum to use a device of more one-person isolated shows, which in the new documentality doesn't apply. It's a more mélange kind of... But I mean, even that breaks down. In most spaces, you'll find kinds of interference of one work with another. That kind of interference seems to become a positive aspect in the Neue Galerie, where it's a deliberate attempt, and in many ways that's probably the clearest part of the show, and the one which it's most possible to construct a discourse around most of the work. I mean, not all of them, but most of the works within that section. Because they all, to one extent or another, engage or disengage or confront or obliterate works within the Neue Galerie. The Otterneum, where I have my other work, seems almost like a self-contained little show. Which is fine. I mean, I think that works quite nicely. But again, why? I can understand why Baumgarten was there, and I can understand to some extent why the artists were there, to do with that notion of natural history and the extent to which the artists there work with something like natural history. So, like three or four of the artists there do have that kind of association. That's about it.
So, I mean, arising out of that, I mean, do you think there's a particular or a specific agenda that this documenter will be remembered by?
It's too soon to say that, to really kind of give a summary of that. There does seem to be more a more deliberate attempt to let work impose upon other works than... and to view that as a positive confrontation rather than a negative confrontation, and to encourage that, so that those little blue hands with the plastic bottles, which are a kind of crass example of that, are sort of permitted to proliferate throughout the Friedrichshafen and the Neue Dokumente Hall. But there are, you know, other occasions where you can see that there is a sort of a deliberate kind of confrontation, like the most explicit, one of the most sexually explicit works is juxtaposed next to some of the most worked abstract paintings, and those kinds of confrontations must, in some senses, be deliberate rather than just accidental.
Going back a while, and I'm not sure whether I remember exactly what you said, but you were concerned about the criteria by which the work succeeded or didn't succeed, and I wondered if you could talk about that in relation to the piece that, you know, your piece that we're standing next to, and the sounds are of people climbing all over it, mm-hmm. and so on. I mean, how do you view it now that it's installed, it's in context, and it's open, and the public are here, and people are actually using it almost as a focus?
Is that an aesthetic question?
Yeah.
I'm not 100% satisfied with the surface of the wood. I could wish it to be slightly less matte, and it was originally, but I had to replace some surface, and it was impossible to regain the matte surface. So, I mean, that's just a technical question. The continued ability of the work to succeed actually depends to a large extent upon the care to which it's sustained. So that, for example, it's very inviting for people to throw rubbish into the centre, and unless that's kind of cleared out on a daily basis, then the work will very quickly fall prey to a misuse rather than a use. I mean, similarly with grass cutting. So that those seem to be peripheral concerns in relationship. I mean, in some ways, peripheral concerns in relationship to the agenda for making the work. But actually, as time goes on, become kind of very central in relation to its continued ability to sustain its place. And I have asked for those things to happen. The My view as to its success or its failure as a piece of work, I don't think you can ever be kind of, I can never be 100% satisfied anyway, which is a sort of sine qua non for being an artist. But broadly, this is almost, apart from the work in Sonsbeck, this is one of the very few times when I've put a work in a park. And as public spaces, parks are a lot of the time pretty well used without sculpture, and pretty well exist pretty well with just people and trees using them. So, I mean, I had some hesitations about putting the work here, but then it is a temporary exhibition. And that was partly the reason for wanting to make it to reduce the height. And also to reduce the height in order to exploit the ability to see the work from the surroundings. Those things, I think, work formally very well. I mean, the work does work very well from the top, and as you come down and as you walk from distance, it does have a real kind of dynamism to it. Dynamism is the wrong word. It does have a real ability to sustain its place. In regard to whether it sort of fulfills its objectives, I mean, that, in a sense, when you make a work, you also discover what the objectives are. So it's hard to know within a couple of days whether it fulfills them or not. It just takes longer than that. Mm.
But I was interested, going on from what I heard you talking about in relation to what the work was and the name of the work and the kinds of themes that there were in it. The degree to which just a kind of very basic play of the elements is important, the idea of the kind of visual evocation of other elements like the sea and the air from the kinds of forms and the materials you're using here, and the very obvious thing that it's placed on land, and that when you see it from above, that placement on land is emphasised as well.
Yes, those things are important. It's actually also, I chose the material because of its responsiveness to light. This aluminium particularly is very beautiful in light. As the evening goes on, it picks up the colour from the wood. So in the morning and evening light, you get you can see it there. You start to get that kind of glow coming.
That's off. The aluminium you're describing.
Yeah, you start to get the glow coming off the. Coming onto the aluminium from the work, and the title of the work and its landed quality yes, there is an element of those two coming together.
I don't know how much further to push those kinds of things. I mean, one has to use words to describe the shapes of the forms. I mean, the one that you used is pod. It's a kind of pod-like form, but then also there is obviously the sense of a kind of the upturned hull of a boat.
Yes.
There are kinds of formal references to aeroplanes as well, the idea of propellers and so on and so forth.
And also the fact that it's a fabricated structure too. Which
the actual, the kind of ring, the sort of oval ring also has upturned ends.
Yes, and there, and also there is a the reason for the upturned ends was, I tried to explain, was to stop this being a subsidiary element to the centre, and in some ways also the break in material has something to do with that as well. Putting it together, I mean, I suppose there's probably a simple way to answer your question. Putting it together, I got a lot of questions as to what it was, continuously questions. What is it? Is it a whale? Is it a fish? Is it a boat? Is it a bottle? Is it a bomb? You know, etc. I mean, and the answer to there isn't really any answer to those questions, because the answer is yes and no to all of those questions, but there is but within those the kinds of objects that it evokes do and I don't know whether this has to do with the sort of self-containedness. The question in relationship, particularly in relationship to the wood, would be then whether as in Anthony Gormley's piece, where he ended up with the goose and with the hand grenade and the egg and the certain kind of completeness of form does produce certain kinds of associations in the viewer. I mean, it's quite a because the range of things that people have asked me what it is have been distinctly limited. They've not asked me if it's a man or a horse. Though no one's also asked me whether it's a landscape, which I think it does have quite a strong landscape element, particularly if you view it from the side, from down here. I mean, from down here, from the bottom level of the park, when you view it from the side, the way the centre rises against the aluminium is distinctly parallels distinctly both the hillside behind and also does suggest the landscape, which. Whereas from above, that doesn't apply at all. That's not an association you would put on it, because the thing is in the landscape very definitely, and kind of rather than representing it or conveying a landscape. So you'd have a thing the further away you are from it, the closer you are to it. Whereas the closer you are to it, the further away. Some of those associations are, you know. I mean, if it's a landscape, then it's obviously distant. Whereas if you're seeing it as a contained object, then it's has much more proximity. It doesn't involve the same kind of represented distance or imagined distance. Rather, imagined is a better word.